This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 10 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Friday, March the 9th, and it's time for our Friday Week in Review. Every Friday after 8, we welcome in two guests from different perspectives to talk about the news of the week, and we have lots to talk about this week, like Congress and Iraq setting a timetable for Iraq, the guilty verdicts in the Louis Libby trial, lots of state news as well, including some news in the race for state Supreme Court. And there's some fallout with the indictment of a major contributor to Governor Jim Doyle's campaign. We'll talk about all of these issues and more, and whatever else you want to talk about at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890. 263-1890. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Let me welcome our guests, and we are very happy to have them both with us. Ann Althaus is a professor of law at UW-Madison, contributing op-ed writer for the New York Times. She blogs at althaus.blogspot.com. Good morning.
Good morning.
And also with us, Bill Leaders, news editor of Isthmus, Madison's alternative weekly newspaper. He is also president of the Wisconsin Freedom of Information Council and author of the book Cry Rape. Good morning.
Good morning.
Where should we start? Bill Leaders, I'm going to ask you, where should we start? What do you think this happened this week that is most significant?
Well, let's talk about Dennis Troha and this indictment and the political fallout for Governor Doyle. This isn't the first case that has suggested that there's quite a strong element of pay-to-play that's going on in the Doyle administration. I don't know if that's entirely fair or entirely true, but it comes up again and again. Clearly, there's a huge amount of money that goes into the governor's political machine. He spent $10 million to get elected, and you don't raise $10 million to get elected unless you, you know, actively engage in taking money from all sorts of people who are essentially interested in favors in exchange for their contributions. Dennis Troha, who was just indicted last week expressly for allegedly making illegal contributions to Doyle's campaign and for lying to investigators about it, is the governor's single biggest contributor. Yeah. He and his family have given nearly $500,000 to the governor and to the Democratic Party over just the last 6 years. So he's a huge campaign contributor, and now he's facing this criminal indictment. He is, of course, entitled to the presumption of innocence. He said that what he did, his lawyer said that what he did, didn't violate any law. But clearly, this individual is giving all this money because he expects something in return. He wants approval of this casino, or he did want approval of this casino near Kenosha. He eventually bailed as a partner in that project just before the indictment came down. But this is obviously an attempt to buy influence from the governor. And people don't attempt to buy influence unless they think that there's some possibility of success.
Yeah. Ann Althaus, what do you think of this story?
Well, I don't know as much about it as you do, and I don't have much to add to that other than it's obviously really troubling and we should be following the story.
Now, the governor did make some comments this week in an interview, which, of course, I can't find right now, but he said, there was nothing wrong going on here. They received the campaign received donations from this Troha, and didn't do anything wrong in accepting those donations. Isn't that right, Bill Leaders?
Well, that's what he says. And, you know, on that part, maybe he's right. Maybe the governor himself didn't do anything wrong. There's another aspect of the story. Maybe Troha did something wrong. He's the one who the accusation is against.
Yeah, the charges are is that somehow he had his family members also funnel money so he could exceed the limits of campaign contributions.
There's a limit on how much you can give, and so he allegedly gave the money to family members so that they could write checks to the governor, and you know it was just a way of evading the contribution limits that individuals face. You know, clearly this guy is interested in giving as much money as he can to our governor. He gave the maximum allowed, which is $50,000 for the last inaugural ball, and which doesn't have the same limit as campaign contributions to the governor's campaign. And, you know, I just think it's naive for anyone, and it's it shouldn't be accepted when his attorney comes forward and says, you know, there was no expectation of personal or business gain out of these contributions? Of course there was. That's why you give money at that level.
Well, can I say something? I mean, this is the standard problem one has in politics. When you have campaign limitations, when you have campaign finance laws, people try to stay within it and use what they can to stay within it and not make actual violations. But even if you haven't violated campaign finance law, and even if you don't have a specific deal that you're getting something for it, there's still influence. I mean, that's just a standard problem in politics. I'm not sure how one gets around that other than through political criticism and just exposure, whether this is actually, corruption that requires a legal remedy is, I think, a different question. I mean, isn't there a remedy just in talking about that and saying, look, all this money went to Governor Doyle's campaign, and then look at what actions he took? I mean, we can see those things happening and criticize the political sphere.
Well, he hasn't done anything with regard to the casino yet. That will eventually possibly be a decision that will fall to the governor. I find it really interesting that in direct consequence of this scandal, the Republican leadership of the legislature is once again agitating for a bill that would give power over approval of casinos to the legislature and take it away from the governor, which is something they've done in the past, and the governor has vetoed it, and that's probably what would happen again. But I think what's happening is our state legislature, the Republicans in the legislature, are looking at these hundreds of thousands of dollars that are flowing from the casino interest and from people like Dennis Troha to the governor, and they're just sick about it. They really want in on that money.
So what do you think of the solution of moving that power to the legislature? That sounds like a good idea, doesn't it?
I think what it would do is it would switch it would mean that the members of the legislature who control the decision would then be the recipient of all this bribe money. And I think that's what they want.
Yeah, I have Assembly Speaker Mike Hipsch talking about the casino compacts this week.
It's not simply just the latest with Mr. Troha, but the fact that this is becoming a bigger and bigger issue in every part of the state, and the legislature should, as duly elected members of the representatives, should have some oversight as to what's going to happen in off-reservation gaming.
Yeah, and you're predicting, bill leaders, that the legislature, if they pass this bill saying the legislature should have a say in this, that the governor will just veto it.
Well, he's done it in the past, and I think that's probably the way he feels. But actually, I guess I agree with him. I think that, it's much harder to police the potential corruption of the system when you've got a body as big as the legislature who gets to make the decision. Money flows to all sorts of people and they rule a certain way. It's harder to point the finger and say, hey, there was a quid pro quo here, as it would be if, at the end of this process, the governor approves the Kenosha Casino. You'll be able to say, hey, look at all the money he got and look at the decision this one person made. The connection, I think, is more direct.
Yeah, but then the response is, and therefore it's good that one person had the power to make that decision, because we can look at him and say he made that decision and he got all that money. But
yeah, because I think then you could identify that something untoward has happened in the process. You could say, hey, look at all this money and look at the way. And also that's a check on the wrong thing happening. Now, especially with this scandal blowing up in his face, I think it actually hurts. In fact, people have said it hurts the chances of approval of this casino because, the governor just can't come along and say, yeah, good idea, I approve the casino, without suffering a political consequence because of the criminal charges that are now part of this whole process.
Another implication of this Troha affair is that Republicans in the legislature are calling for a delay in the reconfirmation vote of State DOT Secretary Buzalaki. It's scheduled for next week, and Republicans are saying they want a public hearing to hear more about Buzalaki's links to Troha. Apparently, the chief legal counsel for the DOT says that Frank Buzalaki has nothing to hide, did nothing wrong by meeting with Troha, and apparently directing state workers to help settle nearly $1 million in taxes that Troha's trucking company owed in five different states. That sounds kind of strange, doesn't it, Bill?
Yeah, I think it stinks to high heavens. This is a separate issue from what is the Troha and the governor. This is Troha and his transportation secretary, and Buzalaki has a personal connection to Dennis Troha, which is distinct from that of the governor. But from the record that's emerged so far, lawyers within the Department of Transportation looked at Mr. Troha's claim that, you know, he didn't owe this $1 million in taxes in another state, and they decided there was no merit to it. And then the transportation secretary directs one of his lawyers to go on a mission to try to clear up this guy's tax problems and actually sent him to other states, even though there wasn't really money budgeted for such a trip, to help this guy clear up his problems. And now you've got the chief lawyer of the Department of Transportation saying, we're absolutely positive that nothing bad happened here. You know, everything that happened was above board. And then the reporter this morning in the paper asked him, well, did you review the emails that, you know, took place in this thing? There's like 1,700 pages of emails and documents that were released. And the lawyer said, oh, no, I'm just so sure that nothing bad occurred, I'd even have to review the material.
I'll limit my remark to just that laughter.
Okay, then we'll take a short pause and we'll move on to some other issues. We have our lines are full right now. When one frees up, you can fill it at 1-800-642-1234 or 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is our Week in Review, talking this week with Ann Althaus and Bill Leaders. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to The Week in Review, and after 4 this afternoon, you can weigh in with your views on the news during At Issue with Ben Marins after 4 o'clock. To the phones we go, and our first caller is Larry in Madison. Hi, Larry. You're on the air.
Good morning. I'm calling about Annette Ziegler, who is running for Wisconsin Supreme Court. The press reports that her husband is a paid member of the board of directors of West Bend Savings Bank. Also, that the family's real estate firm leases space to West Bend Savings for a branch bank. Since her husband went on the bank's board, she has, according to the press, handled 46 cases in which the bank was a party. Now, the written rules for all judges in Wisconsin state in plain English that if a judge's spouse is a director of a party to a case, the judge must get out of the case or ask each party if it's all right to stay in the case. Annette Ziegler says there's no problem with her staying in those cases because she uses her instincts to know what's right. But there are problems with her her explanation of why she stayed in these cases.
Well, you know what? I know, Larry, you've set the stage for us very well, but maybe we should take it from here and see. Any problems, Bill Leaders, do you think?
No, it's a huge problem. I think the rules are clear in this case that she, at a minimum, had an obligation to disclose to the parties that she had a personal connection to one of the parties in these actions. And she seems clearly to have not done that, at least in a handful of cases that have been investigated and possibly in dozens of cases involving not just West Bank Savings Bank, but other entities in which she has a direct personal stake. So I think that is an ethical lapse on her part, and it doesn't do for her to come along and say, oh, I use a gut check, or it doesn't even do for her to say, I rule things fairly and dispassionately. Maybe she does, but still the parties have the right to know that there's a personal connection, and they have the right to say, you know, I'm not really comfortable with you ruling on this case. She didn't give them that option, and I think that is to her discredit.
Mm-hmm. Ann Althaus?
Well, I think a judge that puts the rules aside and relies on instinct is, first of all, revealing something about how her thoughts about law in general. Second of all, if you go on instincts, you should have good instincts, and these don't seem like good instincts. I think not only the failure to withdraw, but also not even to disclose. I mean, if you disclosed but then didn't withdraw, and you would give people a chance to see, to make their judgment about you, but not disclosing, you know, keeping something undercover, I think that, you know, that looks especially bad because you don't give other people the chance to judge. So I think that there's just a whole cluster of concerns about about one's fitness to be a judge under the circumstances. And I noticed the caller seemed to say 46. I'm seeing in the paper four cases. Maybe he said 426.
Well, that was the first report, and then there were some other cases that have come to light.
And so did he say 46?
The number
46?
Keeps growing. He did, but that number does keep growing in various press accounts.
Well, I guess I want to know what the more there are, the worse it gets. Yeah.
There are four cases that the State Journal checked out, and they talked to the parties and, you know, specifically ascertained, did the judge ever say that she had this potential conflict? And they said no. But there are many more cases, dozens of cases, that she ruled on involving this bank.
You know, Judge Ziegler, following some campaign appearance this week, was asked about this. And she did make a comment about, well, maybe we should start talking about the cases that my opponent's husband is involved in. He's a trial attorney, by the way. Is it really, I don't know, is it fair to bring up every single case that this Linda Clifford's husband is involved in?
I think if you're going to start running campaigns based on studying the spouse, as if the spouse was the candidate, I think we would have a lot of trouble. I think there's sometimes when you go over when you reach a point where somebody is married to someone who has so many problems, that does become part of the campaign. But I think telling the public to go over and start looking at the spouse is it looks like just trying to deflect attention from her problems. Mm.
There is a difference. Yes, Linda Clifford's husband is a trial lawyer, and he does handle medical malpractice cases. And that's something that, you know, people ought to keep in mind. She'll tell you, though, she told me anyway, that that she does feel that the Supreme Court's action in removing the medical malpractice cap in 2005 was an appropriate thing to do. She gave an explanation for that. So she's upfront about where she stands. But there is a difference between these two situations in that what Annette Ziegler is alleged to have done and not notifying the parties is a violation of the rules, the Supreme Court rules that she's expected to follow.
Let's talk about another legal issue. Did you have something else,
Bill?
Let me
just say one other thing about this. This type of issue is what this Supreme Court case is going to pivot on in the public mind, because both sides are going to be throwing accusations at the other, especially with the incredible amount of money that's going to be invested in this race, far more than for any Supreme Court race in our state's history. We're going to see accusation after allegation, after charge, after attempt to assassinate character, not just by the candidates and their campaigns, but these special interest groups who are going to be weighing in big time. And these are not the real issues of the race. Yeah. The real issues of the race are the qualifications of the candidates and the ideological perspective that they bring to the court. They don't want to admit that they even have an ideological perspective, but they do. Linda Clifford is more liberal. Annette Ziegler is more conservative. Whoever wins will change the balance of the court for years to come. It's a tremendously important race, but it's likely to be decided on these missiles that are being launched from one side to another and not on a more substantive discussion of the issues.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. I know that both candidates are appearing before some state bar function to do a debate tonight. Sean Johnson, our Capitol reporter, will be covering that, and we'll talk more about it in our state Capitol report on Monday after 7 o'clock. So, and we also have Linda Clifford scheduled for a candidate forum on Wednesday between 7:30 and 8 o'clock. So that's more on that next week. Another legal issue in the news, we heard the verdicts this week in the Lewis Libby perjury obstruction of justice trial in the CIA leak case. And here's a juror, Dennis Collins, a former reporter, commenting after the jury delivered the verdicts, four guilty verdicts out of five counts.
We are very disappointed.
Oh, I'm sorry, this is
the
lawyer.
Verdict of the jurors. Despite our disappointment in the jurors' verdict, we believe in the American justice system, and we believe in the jury system. We intend to file a motion for a new trial, and if that is denied, we will appeal the conviction.
The juror said that the jury in the jury room was thinking, that they thought that Lewis Libby was the fall guy. They were wondering, where's Karl Rove? Where are these other people we're hearing about? Maybe where is Dick Cheney? That they thought that Lewis Libby was guilty of what he was convicted of, but they thought that he was maybe the fall guy. Ann Althaus, any comment on that?
Well, he was charged with perjury, and that is a different wrongdoing than this other background set of facts that led to the investigation. And there are a lot of people who wanted to be satisfied in their attacks on the administration by finding out, by getting a public trial that would involve saying that that other set of incidents that they think was wrong was in fact criminal. The trial wasn't about that. It was about perjury. He wasn't a fall guy on perjury. If he committed perjury, he was found guilty of it. That stands apart from all of this other stuff. You can commit perjury about something that isn't a crime. That's what the trial was about. And I don't see how he was a fall guy for that. Apparently, he committed perjury, if I believe the juror's verdict. And I think the prosecutor had a focused attention on the part of it that he found criminal and prosecutable. And if it was handled according to appropriate procedure, that's what Libby deserves. It's not perjury is not acceptable. That's a separate wrongdoing. And people's disappointment that the larger problem wasn't criminalized and prosecuted is a political matter, and they're on a political side. And I understand their feelings of disappointment, but apparently they deserve to be disappointed about that.
All right, Bill Leaders.
Well, I feel sorry for Scooter Libby. I mean, who would have guessed that a member of the Bush administration could get in trouble for lying? You know, it must have totally taken him by surprise.
Well, it's interesting that none of the rest of them got caught lying.
Well, what did come out in the trial, I know that the issue that he was convicted on was perjury, which is a serious offense, but what did come out in the trial, and what's clear from this case, is that high-ranking members of the Bush administration did set out to deliberately to kneecap a political opponent and probably...
Kneecap him or just argue against him? If he
Joe
was
Wilson
biased
and his wife, I think that they set out to destroy...
To refute him.
To destroy his credibility through...
He set out to destroy their credibility.
Surreptitious means.
I think that the information that undermined his credibility as someone who was reporting facts about the war was a relevant part of the public dialogue that should have come out.
Well, why didn't they say that? Why didn't they say we still
believe
that?
I think they should have done it a lot
there
better.
There was uranium in Africa instead of saying, hey, this guy's wife is a CIA operator.
No, that she was behind him. Why was he sent on the mission? I think that the facts about that should have come out and should have come out in a more up-and-up way. I don't know why they didn't.
Some are saying that President Bush is going to pardon Louis Libby anyway when he leaves office. Why not just pardon him now? what do you think of that, Ann Althaus?
Well, I think from what he said the other day, it looks like the idea would be, why do it now? There's an election in 08. Though there's going to be all of these appeals and procedures, and certainly that stuff will string out until after the election. So none of the flack from giving a pardon would come out and affect that election. And then when it's all over, well, maybe Libby will eventually win, and then Bush won't have to do it. So I think there's this idea of stringing it out and then waiting until the last minute and deciding whether to pardon. Whether there's already an idea that he will pardon him or not, I don't know. But personally, I don't think that he should pardon him either now or later. He was convicted of perjury. There's no reason to condone perjury. It stands apart from the other criticisms of the Bush administration, as it should. And I don't see why Bush should let him off the hook and act as if you can commit perjury for the administration. I just don't get the argument for perjury, for pardon.
Yeah. Well, a pardon is still a possibility, but Ann is right. Scooter gets at least two more kicks at the cat. He gets the chance to appeal this to an appellate court, and then he has to get a chance to appeal that decision if it's still not favorable to the Supreme Court. And if he prevails at either of those levels, then there's no need for Bush to expend any political capital pardoning him. But by the time those processes play out, it will have gotten toward the end of the Bush administration, thank heavens, and Bush could pardon him without suffering the loss in political capital while he still has need for it. Yeah. I think that's a strong possibility that he will do. But look at this, on this case, look at the tremendous amount of due process that this individual received. This trial, public trial with weeks of testimony, he had the world's best lawyers to present a case in his defense. Losing at that, he gets the right to appeal it to another court. Losing at that, he gets the right to appeal it to another court. In the end, he may even get the Bush Bush himself stepping in to spare him from any consequences for his wrongdoing. Compare that to what's going on with these people that are detainees at Guantanamo, who have no right to counsel, no right to evidence, no right to be tried, and they're bringing them up on these show trials in which they're not even allowed to hear the evidence against them. It's just a stark contrast between the way justice works for some and the way the Bush administration thinks justice should work for others.
Well, the Bush administration accepted the special prosecutor, and there has been no pardon yet, so let's not convict the Bush administration ahead of time. Yeah. He hasn't pardoned it.
We're kind of on a legal
but
theme
I can
here.
Hardly read.
we have Andy in Madison to bring up our next topic. Hi, Andy.
Hi, good morning. Thank you. I think that one story that was overshadowed by the conviction of Dick Cheney's chief of staff for lying and obstructing justice was the hearings on Tuesday that we had in both the Senate and the House Justice Committees dealing with the purge of United States attorneys in the prosecutor's offices around the country. There were 8 prosecutors relieved of their duties, and it came out in these hearings that these prosecutors were under pressure from the Republican senators and representatives such as Senator Domenici and Representative Heather Wilson and others who tried to get them to rush indictments against Democrats. Or to, in the case of, and I think it was Washington State, where Governor Gregoire has been in office since 2004, that they wanted them to go back and reopen up that case and to, you know, carry some water for the Republican Party in terms of charging, you know, voter fraud. And this is just an outrageous political corruption of our legal system, and it's not gotten the sort of attention it needs.
All right, is this outrageous political corruption, Ann Althaus?
Well, if those allegations are true, I watched some of the hearings. I mean, I think that if there was pressure on the U.S. attorneys to use prosecutions for political purposes, and when they stood their ground and didn't yield to that pressure, they were relieved of their duties. If that's what happened, that's terrible.
Yeah. Well, here's what we know. The Attorney General removed 8 U.S. attorneys last fall. Several of those cases appear highly questionable. In one case, this what's his name, Iglesias, David Iglesias, says that there was pressure put on him to probe Democratic lawmakers for wrongdoing. When he resisted that pressure, suddenly he was out of a job. In another case, Carol Lamb was removed after she successfully prosecuted Randy Cunningham accepting bribes. Then there's another U.S. attorney in Little Arkansas who was removed because they wanted to make room for a crony of Karl Rove to be U.S. attorney, so they bumped him out of the way to so that they'd have a job to give this guy. And all of these things would not be possible were it not for a provision in the USA Patriot Act, which removes Senate oversight of presidential appointments to U.S. attorney posts. That was a provision that was passed, you know, supposedly to protect our security, and now there's this evidence that it's being used to undermine the integrity of our justice system.
Another issue in the news this week, we heard testimony from families and others who suffered at the Walter Reed Army Medical Center, mm-hmm. the deplorable conditions there, mold and rats and other things. And President Bush then announced an effort to look into the entire military system across the country, the conditions at the hospitals. And here he is making that announcement.
As we work to improve conditions at Walter Reed, we're also taking steps to find out whether similar problems exist at other military and veterans hospitals. In a way that will bring forth the truth is to create a bipartisan presidential commission. I've asked 2 distinguished public servants to lead the commission, and they have accepted. Senator Bob Dole and former Secretary of Health and Human Services Donna Shalala.
All right, so good start, Bill Leaders, in trying to take care of this problem?
I don't know. I'm not usually impressed by appointing commissions to investigate situations. It's very easy for people not to find things or to get to the heart of the matter. The obvious problem here, it seems to me, is that the Bush administration doesn't really care about the troops. They don't care about the soldiers. We've seen it time and again with regard to the difficulties they've got in getting armor, difficulties they've got in getting training, the fact that they're kept there beyond their tours of duty, the fact that they have such difficulty getting benefits once they get back, and the fact that they're put into these rat holes, like the hotel attached to the hospital in Washington. You know, it's just seems overwhelmingly apparent to me that that's the least of their concerns is the way soldiers are treated.
Well, I rankle at joining this issue up with general criticisms about the war. But obviously, the hospitals need to be far better. And I think that appointing Bob Dole and Donna Shalala is at least a good gesture, and we'll see how that plays out. Obviously, Bush is taking it seriously and expanding it to other military hospitals, and I think he should be given some credit for that.
Let me take a caller or two on this. Dave in Wanakee, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I look at this Walter Reed medical scandal as sort of a slow-motion Hurricane Katrina, where the Bush administration knew about the problems at Walter Reed Hospital for years and just sort of covered it up. And when it was exposed, they told all the soldiers not to talk about it and just were very restrictive to them. Seems like the Bush administration only concern about soldiers is for photo opportunity props.
Yeah. Ann Althaus, lots of people say that these problems were known for a long time.
I really don't have anything to add other than to say I don't like the expansion of the issue into some general charge that he doesn't care about the soldiers and so forth. I think making hospitals good enough is an expensive proposition. It takes a lot of work, and I hope they accomplish that in the future.
Yeah. There is truth to the caller's point, though. There was a House Committee on Government Reform that looked at the medical treatment for soldiers in 2005 and found problems. That didn't prompt any change. There has been some reporting on this issue by Mark Benjamin, in particular on Salon, which has pointed to these problems. This has all come out. If the administration had wanted to pay attention to it, they certainly had the opportunity to learn of these problems and do something about it. Nothing was done until it reached critical mass. In other words, when it got to a point where a big paper like the Washington Post took it on, and that prompted, you know, more media attention.
Well, we're going to take another break. Then we're going to talk about some hot-button issues in the news. Did you hear what Ann Coulter said earlier this week at a conservative conference? We'll talk about that. We'll talk about the controversial comments that a UW law professor allegedly made in class. That's more to that story out this week and more. You can also join us at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine along with Ann Althaus and Bill Leaders. This is the Week in Review on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, hoping you'll stay tuned. Kathleen Dunn is with you after 9 o'clock. Her guest will say that despite the differences between the Korean War, the Vietnam War, and the Iraq War, there are important similarities, beginning with the reaction of the three presidents who waged them. That's coming up after 9 o'clock. This is our Friday Week in Review. We are talking with Ann Althaus and Bill Leaders about big things and maybe not so big things that made news this week. Earlier this week, and it got a lot of attention when conservative commentator writer Ann Coulter got into some hot water when she was at the Conservative Political Action Conference. And she said this, and I need to let listeners know that the language she uses may offend you.
I was going to have a few comments on the other Democratic presidential candidate, John Edwards, but it turns out that you have to go into rehab if you use the word faggot.
Yeah, there we go. Well, Ann Althaus, what do you think of what Ann Coulter had to say? A lot of people
I don't know if people get the reference, but there's an actor on, I think, Grey's Anatomy who was sent to rehab for using
Isaiah Washington. Yeah. Isaiah Washington used that F word to describe one of his co-stars and then apologized and said he was going to rehab. And so,
Yeah, I think it was to use a Kerry expression, I think it was a botched joke. Not a good joke, and I don't think it's, what she does, I really have always considered her sort of a comedian. You know, she thinks she's very funny. For people who side with her, they enjoy the humor. It's off color at that point. I think mostly she tries to keep it political. I think if you don't agree with her politics, it's not funny at all. And if she goes over the taste line, then people who are out to you know, out to discredit her, which for understandable political reasons, are going to latch on to that and make a big deal about that. But, you know, I think that the big problem is that she gets invited to something that looks like a fairly serious political meeting. But I think she's really more like a comedian who's kind of pushing the edge of things politically and really shouldn't be heard by outsiders or something like that. I don't approve of using that word, and I don't approve of, well, you know, she explained herself, I think, she did a little interview on the Hannity and Colmes show where she said it was just a schoolyard taunt. It's like saying, oh, he's a sissy. I think she was trying to invoke that Isaiah Washington thing and the idea that if you're politically incorrect, it's viewed as a mental disease and you're sent to rehab, which sounds like you're sort of protesting the... Obviously, I don't think that people who have inappropriate ideas or prejudiced ideas should be viewed as mental patients. I think there is something wrong there that's worth referring to, but I think it was dumb to say it the way she did. It was a stupid joke. She is, to a large extent, kind of a comedian and is occasionally sort of funny, but it's not funny. People don't agree with her politics, and I think it provided just a ripe, juicy opportunity for people who don't like her to slam her. Yeah. But, you know,
well,
she was talking about...
Yes, yeah, but what do you think, Bill? We got some callers, too.
Count me among those who didn't find the humor in her remark. Clearly, she was trying to say that John Edwards is a homosexual and that she thinks faggot is a perfectly appropriate...
Well, I don't think she was trying to say he was a homosexual. I think she was trying to say he was sort of a sissy or weak man or a metrosexual type of man who sort of cares about looking glossy and handsome and doesn't really have much substance. I think it was used like that, like we might call someone a sissy. I don't think it's appropriate to use that word to call someone a sissy. I think it's appropriate to mock politicians, but I don't think that word should have been used.
Talk about not having much substance. You know, I wonder, is there anybody in America who does not consider Ann Coulter repulsive? She's just a horrible human being.
She's on Hannity and Colmes and a lot of talk shows. I see her
bit. I wonder if she isn't some sort of joke. You know, if it isn't really just somebody's idea of a spoof that that such a person exists, that her whole persona is really just a way to call attention to the fact that some Republicans will laugh at anything. And at some point in the future, she's going to be on Hannity and Colmes and she's going to rip off this mask and we're going to see it's really the guy who played Borat.
See, now you are making an insinuation about sexual orientation there, which people do against her. I'm going to call you on that. People will sometimes refer to her as a man, will call attention to the way she looks and act like she's a transvestite. And you just did exactly that. So I think there's a little sexual orientation humor coming from you and coming from her opponents. And I want to pick that ripe, juicy nugget in politics.
You know, let me just shift this discussion a little bit. Arianna Huffington was on a talk show I was watching, and she was saying that the media should stop going to Ann Coulter because she spews this venom. What about that? Maybe should the media take Arianna Huffington up on that suggestion, Bill Leaders?
I think the less attention she gets, the better. I just think she's just a horrible person.
Well, she's some of the people on the left who are like that, too.
She says nothing useful or constructive. She's just mean and nasty and horrible.
I don't think it is.
I think Michael Moore and Al Franken
are
quite a bit different in every way you can quantify.
All right. Ken in Black River Falls, I think, is going to defend Ann Coulter. Hi, Ken.
I'm not really defending her. I used to be a ghostwriter for Al Capp, and I'll tell you something. If you don't like what she says, don't listen. It's that simple, and she can say anything she wants. It's still a free country the last time I looked. Get used to it. If you don't like it, live someplace else. Try Cuba.
Wow, a ghostwriter for Al Capp. I'm impressed.
That's
nice to hear
interesting.
From you.
Hey, I'm not saying she should be censored. I'm just saying what she said is reprehensible.
Yeah.
That's just my speech.
Bill and
don't like it, move to Cuba.
Bill in Milwaukee, hi, you're on the air.
Yes, I would take issue with your guest who characterized this as just simply being in poor taste. It was absolutely an egregious remark for two reasons. First of all, given the way the Bush administration has exploited the issue of sexual orientation and so forth in previous elections, very manipulatively. And furthermore, I would like to ask your guest if she would be equally as blasé about this if Ann Coulter had said, well, I would comment on Barack Obama, but I don't want to use the N-word. Would you like to comment on that, ma'am?
Well, I didn't approve of what she said either, so of course I wouldn't like that either.
All right, here,
I think I'm being completely consistent.
Here, Democratic presidential candidate Barack Obama can't get away from the word articulate. I just pulled this off of this morning's wire. Apparently, Karl Rove is the latest to tell a crowd that the Illinois senator is charismatic, he's articulate, and a very strong figure on the national stage. President Bush a while back said that Obama's an attractive guy. He's articulate. Joe Biden got into more trouble because he said he was clean, but he also said he's a nice-looking, articulate guy. It's apparently, Bill Leader's an insult to call a black presidential candidate articulate.
Well, I think Biden's remark, the suggestion was that he meant as opposed to other people who are black. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure that was a fair assumption to make about his statement. But that was what I don't see what the problem is of calling Barack Obama articulate. He is. He is charismatic. You know, those are just words that come to mind when you describe him.
Some of it is that no one's saying, I don't know, Hillary Clinton is an articulate person.
She isn't as articulate.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, but there's a long history of kind of acting like it's really impressive if a black person does something that you don't mention that a white person does, and the implication is racist. So, I mean, I don't think it should be that articulate becomes this, you know, you can't give compliments to black people because it will be interpreted as meaning that you're implying that other black people don't have those things. You know, I think we have to worry about getting too repressive there. But I do think that we should think about what we're doing. I mean, why did Barack Obama become such an important candidate all of a sudden? The whole situation is a little strange.
Yeah, we have Roy in Black River Falls with another controversial comment in the news this week from Bill Maher's television show. Hi, Roy.
Good morning. I guess I'm just commenting on the kicking of the cat of Ms. Coulter. I do not defend anything that she says in there, but Mr. Bill Maher on his recent TV program said some very inflammatory remarks about the vice president.
Yeah, this was the Huffington Post had some bloggers who posted comments that said, too bad Dick Cheney didn't die in that assassination.
Too bad they missed,
In Afghanistan, the bombing. And Huffington Post took those postings down. This was being discussed on Bill Maher's show, and he didn't say that specifically, but he did in the heated debate say, well, he had no doubt that if Dick Cheney weren't alive, that a lot of other people would be alive, referring to the war casualties. Was that inappropriate, Ann Altos?
I think it's getting close to the edge. Bill Maher is a comedian, however. Comedians say edgy things, and they get in the press for doing it. Look, we're talking about him.
Yeah. Bill Leaders?
I don't really have a basis for gauging the statement. It sounds to me like it does come close to the place where we defend people, and maybe he shouldn't have said it. But
well, let's talk about another some more controversial speech. And Ann Holthaus, you know a whole lot more about this issue than I did. A UW law professor, he was in hot water because some students thought he made some disparaging remarks about Hmong people and the Hmong culture. Mm-hmm. And the law school dean apologized for offending these students. There is some forums over all of this. And now this UW professor has come forward to say, I did not say what is being attributed to me. I was talking about the law and culture and how the two clash sometimes. Talk about this.
You know, obviously this is a very touchy issue in my workplace, and I'm not here to criticize anybody, but what I would like to say is that there has a long tradition at the University of Wisconsin Law School of teaching from a law and society perspective, of teaching in a way that shows how law has an effect on the real context of life, and to bring sociological information into the classroom. And that's what Professor Kaplan, who's the target of this, was trying to do with his class. So he was trying to talk about how law, which is sort of presented in the abstract and deals with people as if they're all alike, has different impacts on different kinds of groups. And he was trying to present as I understand it, mostly from his statement, but also from understanding the law in action approach of the law school, that he was trying to talk about how the laws that the majority makes don't have the same impact on different groups. So he was trying to bring in some detail about different groups, not to make stereotypes, as the original quotes came out, and I think there was later a concession that those quotes, that wasn't quite accurate the way those quotes were assembled. The way the quotes were presented in the press initially was that he had said all of this group are in a certain way and things like that, as opposed to trying to present law in a sociological context. It's very important for the law school to be able to do that and continue to do that. That's part of our tradition. And it may be hard for students sometimes to understand exactly what that is, but another important thing about the law school is that we care very much about diversity and having people from different backgrounds. That enriches the classroom experience too. And if people people feel hurt and offended by the way something is presented, that's also a concern. And there was just a clash of two things that we really care about, which is the law and society presentation of law and the diversity of the student body. And in trying to balance those things, in trying to make that work, we faced some terrible conflicts, and we're still in that conflict. And I think people mean well, but there are some terrible conflicts that have arisen that I think we need to look very closely at. It's a difficult thing, and I hope we can get through it.
Yeah. Bill Leaders?
There was a real rush to judgment here, and it was terribly unfair to Professor Kaplan. The students rushed to judgment in based on somebody's secondhand account of things that he said, and that account turned out to be mostly false. And the administration rushed to judgment in apologizing to students. If it's as though the mere fact that people were offended was all the information it needed. It didn't say, hey, mm-hmm. we need to look into this. We need to get to the to ascertain what was actually said, and then we'll issue an appropriate response. They said, we're sorry. We're sorry you were offended. And I think that was a terrible thing for the administration to do.
I think that there was an idea that you could deal with the feelings apart from the truth.
No, yes.
And
you're right.
I don't think I think there was an idea that you could package and put it in the past what really happened. Let's put that aside and let's just deal with the fact that the students felt offended and treat that as a with a rally. And I think that there was an idea that you could treat the subjective feelings without worrying about objectively what happened. I think that really is a problem, and that the law school needs to model the interest in the search for truth. But I understand the idea that the subjective feelings of the students exists in a separate way that could be dealt with.
You know, we have less than a minute. Bill Leaders, I know you wanted to touch on an appeals court decision that has to do with open meetings laws. Can you do it in that amount of time?
There's a case involving Milton City Council in which the appellate court has just ruled that a meeting that it conducted claiming there need to be a competitive and bargaining reason for shutting this meeting to the public while they meetings, it was a series of meetings to locate an ethanol plant in Milton, that these closed meetings were not proper. This is a tremendously good decision. The court essentially said that just because public officials would rather not conduct their business in public is not a good reason.
And we'll have to leave it there. Thanks to both you and Althaus Bill Leaders for being our guests on the Week in Review. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.